This conference is bringing together different communities, in particular philosophers and physicists. Now, my talk will have two parts. The first part will be messages which I'm quite convinced about, namely that we need a paradigm shift in order to describe our universe cosmology. And this is maybe news to some of the philosophers, the reasons for the need for this paradigm shift. And then the second part of that talk.
See, I was trying to avoid being recorded. Now I have to be careful with the kind of claims that I'm making. So the second part of my talk is going to be an attempt to develop a new paradigm. And I'm very much aware that this paradigm may be much too naive. And there I would actually like the feedback from all of you, in particular for the philosophers, about in which way the approach that I'll be presenting, although I'm very excited about this approach, in which way it's too naive. So let me start with the part which I really want to persuade you about. So I think all of you have been told that the inflationary universe scenario is the current paradigm of our universe cosmology. Now, inflation is usually discussed at the level of an effective field theory. And I'll make precise what I mean by effective field theory in a little bit. And now what I want to convince you of is that there are fundamental conceptual problems with an effective field theory description of a rapidly expanding universe. And these are not minor issues. It's basically violation of unitarity and inconsistency with the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, so to make a provocative statement, the analyses of inflation which you read in textbooks are non-unitary and violate the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, now, anyway, if I manage to convince you of these points, then obviously we need to do something better. And here I will take a very, in a certain sense, conservative point of view, because I'm going to take a particular model which was proposed 25 years ago. It's a matrix model, the BFSS matrix model, Banks, Fischer, Schenker, and Susskind, and I'll try to see what we can do with that. Okay, so first of all, what are the problems of an effective field theory description of a rapidly expanding universe? And I have to give credit to Ted, because it's certainly from Ted that I first heard about this problem. In the context of this space-time diagram, so where's the hockey stick?
Robert, your mic is falling off.
Your mic is falling off? Oh. You're really done.
I'm really trying not to be recorded.
Yeah, you could keep an eye on it.
Called cosmic censorship.
Okay, is that better?
So.
Okay, so Big Bang, period of inflation, post-inflation, standard Big Bang expansion. And here in this diagram, I sketch different length scales. First of all, the horizon, which is the forward light cone of some point on the initial Cauchy surface. And during the period of inflation, the horizon expands exponentially. Then there's a Hubble radius, which is the inverse expansion rate. It's a local concept. And this is constant during inflation. And then this red curve is the physical length of fluctuations that we measure today in terms of microwave anisotropies and distribution of galaxies. And in the period of exponential expansion of space, this length scale, the physical length, expands exponentially. And so and then there's this fourth length, which is the boundary of the zone of ignorance, the Planck length or the string length. And you see that if inflation lasts long, then all scales that we observe today start out at early times in this zone of ignorance. So therefore, 25 years ago, Jérôme Martin and myself said that there's a breakdown of effective field theory And new physics must be taken into account when one studies predictions of inflation. Now, after giving this a seminar on this at the Simons Institute, Bedroya and Wafa came up with a censorship conjecture, the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. They said that ultraviolet physics must prohibit this bad thing from ever happening. The bad thing is that trans-Planckian modes become super Hubble. So the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture means that if you start at any early time t sub I with a Planck length, and you evolve that scale to any later time t sub r, you have to remain smaller than the Hubble radius at this later time. So effective field theory models don't have to satisfy this, but the conjecture is that any consistent model of quantum gravity must satisfy this. Now, I'm going to give three justifications for this trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. The first one is an analogy with Penrose's black hole censorship. So I think everyone who's taken general relativity knows that if you take a black hole with a small charge, then an observer far away from the black hole center is shielded from the singularity by a horizon. However, the effective field theory of general relativity admits solutions with charge greater than the mass. And for those solutions, the observer far away from the black hole is not shielded from the bad stuff that happens at the singularity. And so Penrose's conjecture is simply that the theory that completes general relativity must prohibit this. So now let's translate Penrose's black hole cosmic censorship conjecture to cosmology with this translation scheme. Position space for black holes becomes momentum space for cosmology. The singularity for black holes becomes the space of trans-Planckian modes. And the black hole horizon are replaced by the Hubble horizon. And so Penrose, translated to cosmology, says that an observer measuring super-Hubble modes must be shielded from the trans-Planckian modes. Now, the reason why I'm taking the Hubble radius to generalize the black hole horizon is that fluctuations, so the small density perturbations that become our galaxies and induce microwave anisotropies, they only oscillate on sub-Hubble scales, and they freeze out and classicalize on super-Hubble scales. And so when we replace Penrose's black hole horizon by the Hubble horizon, we make the very conservative statement that we demand that only the classical region be insensitive to the trans-Planckian region. So that's the first justification for the TCC. Now, the second justification is non-unitarity of the effective field theory description. This dates back to a paper by Nathan Weiss in 1985. So now, by effective field theory, I mean that we take all fields that live on space-time, we expand these fields in Fourier modes, co-move in Fourier modes, and we quantize each Fourier mode as a harmonic oscillator. That's what one does in effective field theory. Now, in order to avoid the Planck catastrophe, you need an ultraviolet cutoff. And this ultraviolet cutoff has to be at a fixed physical scale. And in order to maintain the fixed physical scale in an expanding universe, you have to continuously create modes, which is non-unitarity. And so if you demand that the classical region be insensitive to the non-unitarity, then you get the trans-Planckian censorship conjecture. So that's a second justification. And a side remark, which I'll come back to at the very end of the talk, is the following. If we expand fields in co-moving Fourier modes, if we do effective field theory, then we run into the cosmological constant problem because each harmonic oscillator has vacuum energy. So the hypothesis that I want to put forward is that the usual quantum view of the cosmological constant problem is an artifact of doing the wrong thing, namely doing effective field theory analysis. And I'll come back to this at the very end of the talk. Now, the third and weakest justification of the TCC is an entanglement entropy argument. Now, in terms of black hole physics, entanglement entropy is a hot topic. One studies entanglement entropy between sub-horizon and super-horizon things. So let's do the same thing in cosmology. We can study the entanglement entropy between sub-Hubble and super-Hubble modes. And in an accelerated universe, the phase space of super-Hubble modes is increasing, and therefore the entanglement entropy is increasing. The entanglement entropy density is increasing. And if we demand that the entanglement entropy density remains smaller, then the entropy density in the thermal gas that we want after inflation, you get the TCC. So basically, an effective field theory description of inflation runs into this unitarity problem and problem with the second law of thermodynamics. OK, so what does this mean for inflation? This is a slide. This and the next slide are mainly for cosmologists. So this is my space-time diagram of inflation, the inflationary phase, post-inflation. Now, the Transplanckian censorship conjecture means that if we take the Planck length at the beginning of inflation, it can't become larger than the Hubble horizon at the end of inflation. I drew this condition to be marginally satisfied. So the TCC sets an upper bound on the duration of inflation. But if inflation is to be successful, then the current Hubble radius has to emerge from inside of the Hubble radius at the beginning of inflation. Otherwise, we lose the causal generation mechanism of fluctuations. We lose the successes of inflation. I drew this condition to be marginally satisfied. This is the current Hubble radius. In this diagram, it emerges right from the Hubble radius at the beginning of inflation. So inflation being successful gives you a lower bound on the duration of inflation. You have an upper bound and a lower bound. And whether these are consistent depends on how large the Hubble radius is during inflation compared to the Planck scale. The lower the energy scale of inflation, the easier it is to satisfy these conditions. You do the algebra, and you find that the energy scale of inflation has to be five orders of magnitude lower than what is usually assumed in order to make these satisfy both inequalities. And if you construct such a low energy scale inflation model, you have to work hard to get enough density perturbations. If you achieve this, then the amount of gravitational waves are utterly negligible. So for those of you who are not cosmologists, whenever you hear someone saying that primordial gravitational waves is a smoking gun signal of inflation, nothing could be further from the truth. So, OK. There are also consequences of the TCC for...
I think that's a little bit of what's pushing it, obviously. I mean, you're putting this extra Transplanckian censorship on top of inflation. So inflation in itself, I mean, if this censorship is not the case, it's not...
I will...
Yeah.
It is still not correct. I'll come back to that in the next section. There are also some consequences of the TCC for late-time cosmology. It means that dark energy cannot be a cosmological constant, and toy models called quintessence models are constrained. Dark energy is something much more subtle.
Wait, sorry, why would it imply? Because in the future, TCC...
Exactly. Okay, so now you might worry. So I try to argue that the usual descriptions of inflation are in trouble. Well, what does that mean for observations? Well, we do not need inflation. Okay. We would like to have a theory that reproduces the data and that makes predictions for future observations. So here's a data slide. This is shows the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background, angular scale, and this is the amplitude of anisotropies. And so the data points from the W map are the black dots. And there's some statistical uncertainties, some systematic uncertainties. And now there was an artist who was given six parameters to draw a curve which fits the data quite well. And this is this red curve. Six late-time cosmology parameters are tuned to get this red curve. Now the artists who drew this curve 10 years before the development of inflation. 10 years before the development of inflation. The artists are Zeldovich and Zunyaev and Peebles and Yu. And here's a reproduction of a figure in Zeldovich and Zunyaev. So time, space, Here I'm using co-moving coordinates, coordinates which expand as space expands. And here, Zeldovichians have assumed that there's some process that in the early universe produces small amplitude density perturbations on all scales. Now, these density perturbations are frozen in while the wavelength is larger than the Hubble horizon. This is the Hubble horizon. This is a time of recombination when the microwave background is released. Now, you look at this scale. This scale has had no time to oscillate because it just comes into the horizon at recombination. So we catch this scale at maximal amplitude, maximal microwave anisotropy. This scale has done 5/4 of an oscillation. We catch it at a node, velocity perturbation, local minimum. So it is this structure which is responsible for these peaks. This is a scale that enters the Hubble horizon right at recombination. So the physics that goes into these acoustic oscillations was well understood 10 years before inflation. It also predicts baryon acoustic oscillations. Now, what Zeldovichians in IF and Peebles and you did not know is how to produce the initial spectrum of fluctuations. And here are the recipes. This is a recipe for a successful early universe cosmology, which can produce these initial perturbations and be in agreement with observation. So first of all, your early universe model, in your early universe model, the horizon, the causal horizon, has to be much, much bigger than the Hubble radius. Otherwise, you don't get the rough isotropy of the microwave background. In order to have a local causal mechanism of generation of fluctuations, the scales that we observe today have to start out at some early time inside the Hubble horizon. Otherwise, you lose the causal generation mechanism. And finally, the mechanism that satisfies this condition has to produce a roughly scale-invariant spectrum of fluctuations. These are the three criteria. Now, inflation satisfies these three criteria because the horizon is exponentially larger than the Hubble radius. Scales emerge from inside of the Hubble radius. And the fact that you have constant energy density during inflation gives you the scale invariance of the spectrum of fluctuations. But I will now show you two other scenarios in which these conditions can be satisfied. The first one is a bounce in cosmology. So scale factor, size of the universe as a function of time, bounce point, contracting phase, expanding phase. This is a result in space-time diagram, time, space, co-moving coordinates. This is the Hubble radius. This is the scale of cosmological fluctuations. So time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity, so the horizon is infinite. Criterion one satisfied. Perturbations start out sub-Hubble at very early times. And it is a fact that there are subclasses of bouncing cosmologies in which the fluctuations become scale invariant. But I will not describe these subclasses here because I'll be more interested in the emergent scenario. Now, the emergent scenario is a scenario where you assume that there is an emergent phase which can be modeled semi-classically as constant scale factor. And then there's a phase transition to a phase of standard Big Bang expansion. So this is the assumption of the emergent universe. And this gives rise to this space-time diagram. Time, space, this is the emergent phase, standard Big Bang phase of expansion. This is a transition point, the phase transition. So time runs from minus infinity to plus infinity, so the horizon is infinite. Scales obviously emerge from sub-Hubble because in the emergent phase, the Hubble radius is infinite. Okay, so criterion two satisfied. And if you have thermal fluctuations in this emergent phase with holographic scaling, then the result in density perturbations and gravitational waves will be scale invariant. So, and coming back to your point, Yash, bouncing cosmologies and emergent cosmologies typically produce gravitational waves, and they often produce gravitational waves with a larger amplitude than inflation. So my statement about primordial gravitational waves not being the smoking gun signal of inflation is true even if you don't accept the TCC.
Sorry, is it crucial for what you just said that the slope of that blue line is almost flat?
Yes, that gives rise to an almost, that gives rise to a negligible tilt of the spectrum.
Right. So, but what's the idea of that flatness is just, it's forever, for a very long time, it's just not changing at all, and you're catching it at the...
See, the way that I presented the emergent scenario is that there's an instantaneous phase transition, in which case this blue curve would immediately go to infinity, in which case you would get an exactly scalar-length spectrum. So this specific form depends on the nature of the phase transitions, which we don't understand. That will be model dependent.
Right, so in a really long time ago, Lemaître, one of the universes he proposed was like this.
It was
a balance between a cosmological constant, I think, and matter. And so it had an infinite lifetime in the past with constant radius, and then exponential escape. Would that model satisfy your conditions?
I think so. You have to give me the reference. I'm not aware of that.
Didn't George Ennis have something like this?
No, that's not. He has a scenario which he calls emergent. That's not this. That's different. Okay. Now, balancing cosmologies and emergent cosmologies are consistent with the TCC, but you need to go beyond effective field theory to get a bounce and to get an emergent cosmology. And I argue that inflationary cosmologies at the level of effective field theory are not consistent. So the bottom line is that all early universe scenarios require going beyond effective field theory. And I should also give credit to my collaborator Keshav Dasgupta and his friends, and Guy Advali and his friends, who are working on inflationary models based on going beyond effective field theory. Okay, so hopefully I've persuaded some of you that we need to go beyond effective field theory in order to describe the very early universe. And see, now I have to start speaking more softly, because now I will be jumping to a topic which I'm less comfortable with. Namely, I will be trying to present a model which goes beyond standard effective field theory. And as a warm-up, I want to remind you of a prehistoric emergent model. So it's work by Waff and myself before the invention of the archive, where we try to see what the new features of string theory that differentiate string theory from point particle theories could give you for the early universe. So we will focus on the new symmetries and new degrees of freedom that string theory has. So specifically, if you have strings and you compare strings to point particles, strings have oscillatory modes and strings can wind space. The fact that strings have oscillatory modes means that a gas of strings has a maximal temperature. Gas of point particles does not have a maximal temperature. That's obviously related to the singularity. The fact that you have winding modes leads to the equivalence of physics on small tori and physics on large tori. So you replace r by 1 over r, r is the radius of space, and then you interchange winding modes and momentum modes, and you get a symmetry. So if you take a gas of strings, and you look at what the temperature of this gas of strings does as a function of the size of the box, then you get this bell-shaped curve. And this looks very much like a metastable state. And so based on this thermodynamic picture, which can be calculated, we made the guess that you would get this emergent cosmology and this space-time diagram. OK, so now what you can do, since we have a gas of strings, we can calculate the thermal fluctuations. And here I sort of want to look in particular at the London, Ontario contingent, because this is now a recipe for computing cosmological fluctuations in gravitational waves if you have some kind of emergent thermal phase. And I sort of wonder if you could do the same thing for spin foams. Okay, so the recipe is the following. You take this initial state, which in our case is a thermal state. You calculate matter correlation functions in this thermal state. And then, mode by mode, when the mode exits the Hubble horizon, you convert the matter perturbations to metric perturbations. And then you evolve the metric perturbations using the usual equations for perturbative generativity, which ought to be correct in the far infrared where we are using them.
Sorry, Rob. I think I don't understand the initial state. Are you assuming it's a thermal state?
Yes.
At some particular temperature?
Yes. See, this comes back to, so we are taking a gas of strings. So this is a thermal state of strings. So we are taking a box of strings in thermal equilibrium. You can compute this curve. Now we will start the time evolution here.
Right.
A thermal state.
The usual inflationary story works because the amplitude of all fluctuations is set by H bar by the.
We are not doing quantum perturbations.
Right.
If you have a high temperature state, the thermal fluctuations will dominate over the quantum fluctuations.
Right. So, of course, there's a question of why there should have been a thermal state. But putting that aside, why should the spectrum be scale invariant?
Because I'm going to calculate it.
Because you have a temperature that's at scale that's alien to what you would have had it in.
Yes. So let me show you how we do that. This is the three steps, okay? Now, what you do is you take a metric which includes cosmological perturbations and gravitational waves. And the cosmological perturbations are given by the energy density fluctuations. The gravitational waves are given by the off-diagonal pressure perturbations. Given the partition function of a thermal string state, you can compute these quantities. And you can compute this. OK? So this is what these energy density perturbations do. They are given in a holographic way by they're given by the heat capacity. The heat capacity is given in this way by the temperature and the radius. So you see the temperature enters here, as you pointed out, and this is the holographic scaling. And then we combine these formulas, and you get the power spectrum of cosmological fluctuations, which is independent of k at first sight, but depends on the temperature. And so you see that you get a scaling invariant spectrum like for inflation. And if you take into account the fact that the temperature, when the scales exit the Hubble horizon, slightly change from scale to scale, then you get a slight red tilt like for inflation.
Sorry, Robert, that confused you. Can you remind why you said the metric perturbations are ignored? Because they were on the left.
No, the metric perturbations are not ignored.
That it's neglected something in the first statement of the.
Okay.
This one, yeah.
Yes. See, we are doing it. If we do a calculation on sub Hubble scales, the metric perturbations are negligible.
Okay.
So this is a prescription. On sub Hubble scales, the matter perturbations dominate. We will compute them. And as soon as the scales become sub-Hubble, we use the constraint equations to convert to metric perturbations. It's the metric perturbations which drive the dynamics.
So I'm saying on the sub-Hubble, they're just spectators?
The matter perturbations, they will induce metric perturbations as well.
But it's kind of a decoupling limit that you don't need to keep track of the degrees of freedom on sub-Hubble?
We will compute the matter perturbations at Hubble radius crossing.
So it's imprinted at that point. So
it's imprinted.
I think maybe better way is if you set G equal to zero for the thermal factor. Well, I mean, for whatever that means, I'm not sure.
No, the background has G.
Okay.
But let me move on. So, but Ted, are you happy with the way that, so the temperature, it comes in, it determines the amplitude of the perturbations.
Yeah, I don't understand why it leads to scale invariance. I would have thought. The temperature would set a special scale, and then
you could make the same statement about inflation. See, in inflation, there's a particular scale, namely H.
No.
But you get a scale invariant spectrum of perturbations.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that it's the dynamics of fluctuations which combines with a particular scale to give you the scale invariance. But let's talk about that afterwards.
Yeah,
so it's really powerful. You do exactly the same calculations as you do for inflation. If I would follow this recipe for inflation, I would use the Gibbons-Hawking temperature, I would get exactly the usual result for inflation. So there's nothing mysterious there. Let's go on to compute the gravitational waves. This is a computation for gravitational waves. What we get is we get a scale invariant spectrum, like for inflation, and a slight blue tilt, unlike for inflation. So basically, let me make another provocative statement. If you find a slight blue tilt of the spectrum of gravitational waves, you will have verified a prediction which was first made in the context of string theory. So please do not say that string theory does not connect with observations. Here is a particular prediction. Now, the problem with this toy model is that I stuck in the background by hand. That's the Achilles heel of string gas cosmology. So let's try to do better. And now I have to lower my voice. So here.
Can I pause you for one second? Because there's something very fundamental, even just accepting your initial condition. Right? Is it essential for your story that the universe has toroidal topology?
For string gas cosmology, I need to have the winding modes, yes.
So every spatial dimension is closed circle?
Not necessarily a closed circle, but the condition is that you need to have long-lived winding modes. That's a condition on the topology. And you see that in this model that I'm going to present now, I do not need that requirement. I will get exactly the same predictions as I got in string gas cosmology without having to put in such an assumption from the beginning, because I'm going to get emergent space and time. OK, so I'm going to start with a matrix model. So it's a model that involves n by n Hermitian matrices. There's no space. And this particular matrix model was proposed 25 years ago as a non-perturbative definition of M-theory. So the claim was that M-theory emerges in the limit where n goes to infinity. So we're going to take this matrix model. And this is the Lagrangian of this matrix model. It involves 9 spatial matrices x sub I. And there's a 10th matrix which is hidden in this object that looks a little bit like a covariant derivative. OK, so this is the Lagrangian. Now, what we are going to do is we are going to take this system in a thermal state, in a high temperature state. So now we have no time left. There's no more evolution. We have no space and no time. Now, by high temperature, I mean the following. If you take these matrices and you expand them in the complex time direction, in Matsubara frequencies, I want the temperature to be so high that the action is dominated by the n small n equals zero modes. So, and this action, the contribution of the small n equals zero modes to the action of the BFSS model is this action here. It is the action of the IKKT matrix model. This is a pure matrix model. There are only matrices. There's no time, no space. There is a partition function. So now we have to get space, time, and a metric, and an early universe cosmology out of this matrix model. That's the goal. All in 5 minutes. OK. So these are Hermitian matrices, so I can diagonalize one of them. So I will diagonalize the temporal matrix. And the eigenvalues of A naught, they are emergent time. I follow the work of Nishimura and collaborators. So we work in the basis in which A naught is diagonal. The expectation value of A naught square scales in this way as a function of capital N. And this shows you that the maximal eigenvalue scales as square root of n. The eigenvalues are symmetric about zero. So in the capital N going to infinity limit, you get an infinite time ranging from minus infinity to plus infinity, no big bang, and is continuous. So this is emergent time. This is not new. So now we focus on the spatial matrices. Okay, now there are these three properties of the spatial matrices which we are going to use. So we look at the off-diagonal elements of the spatial matrices, and we study how do they evolve as we go away from the diagonal. And using the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma and the partition function, you can show that if you go sufficiently far away from the diagonal, these matrix element expectation values decay. And sufficiently far means this far. So these two properties you can show analytically using the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. This property we get from the numerical simulations. So this we do not have analytical understanding. So these are properties of the spatial matrices. Okay, so now we do the following. Now we want to identify emergent space. So what we do is we look at the spatial matrices. We work in a basis in which the temporal matrix is diagonal. And we want to define space at a particular time. So time, we go the same distance down the diagonal, and we look at small ni cross ni subblocks. These are subblocks at a particular time. These are the subblock matrices. And with these, we can study the expectation value. And Nishimura and his collaborators define this as the extent of space parameter. Now, it's been observed using numerical studies that there's a symmetry breaking. In this, only three of these extent of space parameters become large. The other six remain small. This was sort of mysterious observation. But there's a clear physical reason for that. OK, so now what we are going to do is we are going to define these small n as our co-moving spatial coordinates. And we are going to define the extent of space parameter as the physical length of a curve from n equals 0 to n. So physical length defined by the extent of space parameters, my co-moving distance. So we have co-moving coordinates, we have physical length. Now, if you have co-moving coordinates, physical length, you get a metric in this way. So we have emergent space, and now we have the II component of an emergent metric. And then using the properties of the off-diagonal matrix elements, you can show that the GII of NI are independent of NI. And you use the residual SO3 symmetry to then show that GIJ is time-dependent amplitude delta IJ. So if you buy this definition of emergent space, then you get an emergent metric which is spatially flat. Space that emerges is infinite. The metric that emerges is spatially flat. So who needs inflation? OK, let's do a little bit of cosmology in the last couple.
Since this is a philosophy physics meeting, can we focus for a second on what you actually just said about your proposal is that the world is described by a statistical ensemble of matrices with no time and no space.
Yep.
Right. And average properties with respect to the measure of that statistical ensemble look like space-time.
Exactly. Yep. But can we come back to that? That's good to emphasize that. I would like feedback on that. That's exactly the proposal. And that might be complete, that might be much too naive. But let me just do 2 more minutes. So, okay. Did I skip something? Yeah, I skipped something. So in this three-dimensional subspace that becomes large, you can solve the classical matrix equations, and you find that this A of t scales as t to the 1/2, like a radiation-dominated universe. There's no cosmological constant. There shouldn't be a cosmological constant because we never quantize a harmonic oscillator. Okay, finally, the one robust thing we can do is, since we have a partition function, we can compute expectation values of fluctuations. And we can do exactly what I showed for string gas cosmology. So we can compute these correlation functions by taking the derivatives of the partition function with respect to time and with respect to the emergent space. We can compute these quantities. And it was absolutely no surprise to us that what we got was a scale invariant spectrum of curvature perturbations with a slight Poisson contribution on ultraviolet scales, and a scale invariant spectrum of gravitational waves without this Poisson tail. Okay, so I'm almost done. So this BFSS matrix model, if you buy the arguments that I made, which probably you should be careful about doing, it yields emergent infinite time, emergent infinite space, an emergent metric, which is spatially flat, and an emergent early universe phase, which definitely has thermal fluctuations. And these thermal fluctuations definitely lead to scale invariant curvature perturbations in gravitational waves. And there's no.
Robert, are they also blue tilted, like in string gas cosmology?
That we are not yet ready to make a firm statement. And that comes as part of these open problems. So you see, in response to one of Ted's questions, I emphasize that the tilt depends on the nature of this phase transition. We can model it for string gas cosmology. We are not yet ready to model it in this context. I expect the same results, the same tilt, as the same consistency relation as we got in string gas cosmology. So there are a huge number of open problems. This is the beginning of a research program. We need to understand the phase transition. Some of the calculations we did, in particular for when I solved the classical matrix equations at late times, it only included the bosonic matrices, but actually there are fermionic matrices as well. So supersymmetry does play an important role in certain aspects. So what about dark energy? What about the effect of field theory for localized excitations which must emerge at some high energy? So there's a huge number of open problems. So I want to conclude with 2 concluding slides. One is robust conclusions. These are the messages that I want people to carry home. Namely, inflation is not the only scenario of early universe cosmology, which is consistent with data. And in light of the transplanting censorship conjecture, I could have spoken about other issues as well, like the swampland program. We need to go beyond effective field theory if we want to describe early universe cosmology, inflation or non-inflation. So these are so robust messages. And if I've persuaded you about these robust messages, then you have to try to do something. And we try to do something, and we try to get space-time and a metric out of this particular BFSS matrix model. And we seem to get rather exciting results, but it could all be wrong. So this is an attempt, which is interesting, but and I'd like the feedback of the audience on this. So thanks a lot.
So we have time for a few questions. I wanted to follow up on Ted's question to understand in what sense the convergence satisfying the DFS matrix model. So it really is that you're thinking of having a statistical ensemble of matrices. None of the individual matrices have any sense of space and time assigned to them,
right.
But somehow in the ensemble.
It all comes from the ensemble.
And so this is probably crudely put, but I think in terms of other theories, we think of what is the space-time geometry, it's sort of universal geometry that appears in the couplings of all matter fields, say. Right? So is there something like that that comes out when you say that the space-time is emergent? Is it that you could say, you know, any description of how matter fields propagate?
Right. This is related to this point.
Okay.
Now, okay, where are the particles? Where are the strings? So this is, the BFSS matrix model is a proposed non-perturbative definition of string theory. My conjecture is that the strings are solitonic excitations of the matrices. And the origin of the phase transition is the fact that as long as you have solitons, they will prevent the expansion. So the solitons have to annihilate. And in a supersymmetric theory, the solitons will only annihilate if they hit. And this will only allow three of the spatial dimensions to become large. So I think this is the reason why in the BFSS matrix model you have this phase transition. It is the fact that you have strings which are solitonic excitations. So this is now the understanding of the phase transition. Now somehow particles must also arise. And then there must be, the physics must describe the interaction of the particles. And that is here. But we don't understand that.
Any other questions?
Yeah, there was a paper, if I remember, by Aguirre and Cahias.
So by whom?
Aguirre and Cahias. And they claimed that emergent universes are quantum mechanically unstable, so it couldn't exist for past infinity. Is that relevant here? Because maybe they were thinking of Borgelis's model.
See, that's at the level of effective field theory. So you see, you can't get an emergent scenario from GR plus matter that satisfies usual energy conditions. And if you try to do that, then obviously you run into instabilities. So that makes sense.
Yeah, this looks very interesting. I just missed that little point about the three dimensions. Could you say again, how did 3+1 come out from the 10 dimension?
Okay, from the nine spatial dimensions. Okay, now it's been observed using these numerical studies of the matrix model. But my conjecture is that in order for dimensions to become large, the solitonic excitations of the matrices have to be able to annihilate. Because if you have a string wrapped in space, the space cannot expand energetically. And in a supersymmetric model, this supersymmetry plays a very important role for this phase transition. In a non-supersymmetric matrix model, you don't have the phase transition. So I think it's basically the mechanism which Waffe and I discussed back in 1989, which is embedded in this matrix model. This is what I conjecture.
I think Elias Mullin is online, also has a question. You can ask him, but I think I see his hand is raised. Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yes. I've been studying these kinds of matrix models for a long time as a model of hidden variable theories. And I have this particular model studied in about 2002. And they work marvelously. Let me just say I'll discuss them in my talk. But I think that will help to explain your phase transition.
OK, great. So I look forward to your talk, Lee.
Yeah, I'm sorry, maybe one question while Adam sets up.
I can also ask him the coffee break.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone. Let's thank Robert.